Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey there, working listeners. Before we start the show, I want to let you know about a story coming up a little later. It's from one of our partners, SAP. AI comes at you fast. If you don't get reliable and relevant advice, your business might miss out. Whether you're looking to automate tasks or embed AI in your business processes, SAP can help. To learn more, head to sap.com/AI and stick around for expert advice on how to embrace AI with confidence.
A lot of my friends at the time would say, leave your camera at home, just come and dance and enjoy the show. But I wasn't not enjoying the show when I was taking pictures. And the times that I did leave my camera at home, I kind of felt like I would always regret it, you know?
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Ronald Young Jr.
And I'm your other host, June Thomas.
June Thomas, it's wonderful to be here with you once again. Tell me, whose voice was that we hear at the top of the show?
That, Ronald, was Jim Saw. Jim is a photographer who specializes in capturing live musical performances, particularly from the Washington, D.C. punk scene.
Ooh, this is of interest to me as a DMV resident. So I know why I want to hear from Jim, but why do you want to speak to Jim right now?
Well, a couple of years ago, Jim published a book that showcased some of the concert images he took between 1982 and 1997. And that book, in my eyes, sold out really quickly, but it has just been reissued. I was really curious to hear about that scene and especially to talk to a photojournalist who is still working today about how much the profession has changed in the last 40 years. And in short, the answer is a lot.
Yeah, that would make sense. I feel like the punk scene is something that continues to evolve, and to be able to have like a visual history of it seems very, very intriguing. So I'm very excited to hear this interview. But let me ask you this. Do you have anything special and exciting for our Slate Plus members?
Ronald, you know I do. I asked Jim if the 80s and 90s punk scene in the nation's capital was really all that different from the scene in other parts of the world or other parts of the States. I also asked him about some of his favorite collections of art photography, art books, and also of concert photography.
That is amazing. I can't wait to hear it. And if you're a member of Slate Plus, you'll hear that at the end of the episode. If you aren't, it's really easy to join. As a Slate Plus member, you get to hear extra segments on this show and others like the Culture Gab Fest and Care and Feeding, the parenting podcast formerly known as Mom and Dad Are Fighting. You'll get bonus episodes of podcasts like Slow Burn. And of course, you'll never hit a paywall on Slate.com. To learn more, go to Slate.com/WorkingPlus. All right, let's hear June Thomas's conversation with Jim Saw.
When you hear a good idea, it's natural to do a double take. That's what you might do when you hear Discover will automatically double the cashback you've earned on your credit card at the end of your first year with Cashback Match. Wait, what? Yep, double the cashback is something so good you might do a triple take. Get rewarded no matter who you are or how much you spend with Discover. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Jim Saw, welcome to Working. I'm very excited to talk to you about your work photographing the Washington, D.C. punk scene in the 1980s and 90s and the second edition of your book, In My Eyes, Photographs 1982 to 1997. Before we get going, one foundational question. Since we're now more than 40 years out from the beginning of the scene and since the term punk has sort of morphed over the years, I keep hearing and reading headlines that declare sometimes really quite awful things are punk. What did punk mean in that scene back then?
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And that is an interesting question because I just had a talk at the DC Public Library with Ian Mackay, who was in Fugazi and Minor Threat and owns Discord Record and is a luminary here in DC in the punk rock scene. And at one point of the talk, I said, when we were young, we used to differentiate between punk rock. We used to say we're hardcore punk in DC. And I said that, you know, in retrospect, I thought that was a little silly. And Ian said, oh, I wholly disagree with that because what we were doing, and he's right, what we were doing at the time is we were trying to separate ourselves from the nihilistic punk of the Sex Pistols. And there was a band here in DC called Bad Brains that subscribed to this positive mental attitude, PMA. So we were like, we're hardcore punk, not punk. But in my book, in my intro, I end the intro with a quote from Patti Smith that says, punk is just another word for freedom. Mm-hmm. For me, punk was anything that you did that, you know, musically or even artistically, that where you just did what you wanted to do and you didn't cater to any kind of commercial needs or anything. I mean, I wanted to get my photos out there back then and I didn't wait for Rolling Stone or anyone. I published them myself in a fanzine. And, you know, later I did end up in the Washington Post and Rolling Stone and every other music magazine, but I did it myself at the beginning.
I lived in DC during the 80s, and I certainly was not part of the punk scene, but my neighbors were, and I remember they were straight edge punks. And like, there seemed right. Like there were so many different kinds, right? Like what, yep. Like tribes of, even within tribes.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's begin talking about how you got into the 80s DC punk scene. What came first for you, the music or the photography?
They came together. Oh. Really, it was two loves of my life coming together at one time. I started a photography class in high school in the early 80s, and I was liking it. I hadn't really done photography before, but I was really liking the whole process of the black and white photography. And then, as you might remember, having been in DC in the 80s, the Key Theater in Georgetown used to have a midnight show of the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes, yes.
And as bored suburban teenagers, we said we might try that and see what's going on there. And we went down, and before the movie played, they had a DJ and they played punk rock music, and people would pogo and dance and stuff in front of the screen. So I was very in tuned with music. I was a music lover. I have 7 older brothers and sisters that had a lot of music in the house, but it was mostly 60s music. And I heard this music and I was like, oh, this is like my music. You know, this spoke to me. So I immediately went out to my local record store and mentioned the bands that I heard. Like, they were mostly British bands, like the Stranglers and the Buzzcocks and some New York stuff. I'm sure I heard the Ramones and stuff like that. But they told me that there were local bands playing this type of music too. You know, you got to love those record store guys. Those old heads, you know, they're usually grouchy, but they really can turn you on to some great stuff. So I found out that there were bands doing this stuff locally, and I went to my first show shortly thereafter, a band, Minor Threat, which ended up being one of my favorite punk bands of this scene. Mm-hmm. And the first show, I didn't take photographs. I just went to check it out. And then the second show I went to was at the old 930 Club, and I did take photos, and then I couldn't stop taking photos at every show after that.
And how many shows would you go to every week? I mean, like, was this something you were at most nights, or was it, you know, once every couple of weeks?
What yeah, I mean, I was in high school, so yeah. Like getting out every night, and you know, like I said, I was the last of eight, so my parents didn't really pay much attention to where I was going, and they definitely didn't know I was going into the city at night. But I did go probably twice a week. There'd be a hardcore matinee at the old 930 Club at 3 o'clock on Sundays, which was a great way for a kid to spend a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah,
I got to give it to the local punk rockers. That club was originally a 21 and over, but Ian and some of the local punks went to the owner and said, look, we don't want to drink. We just want to have shows. And you're going to be dark at 3 o'clock on a Sunday anyway. So why don't we do these shows and you can put an X on our hand and we won't, you know, if people are over 21 there and want to drink, that's fine. But and they agreed to it. And that's how all ages shows pretty much started in D.C.
Wow. Amazing. Now, so you started to take photographs when you started to go to shows, you used to take your equipment. Now, like, I just am really a little bit hung up on this, because photographing live performances in low light conditions is always challenging. But punk concerts, they were, I imagine, especially difficult because the performers were so free to kind of borrow from Patti Smith, and at least in the UK, there was this culture of what was called gobbing, you know, which would translate as members of the audience spitting on the performers.
Luckily, like, that didn't make it to this side of the Atlantic.
Oh, good, good.
But yeah, we didn't really spit, but we did slam dance or thrash or whatever you want to call it. And yeah, there's lots of energy, lots of movement. I made it this far without getting any gear broken or getting hurt. But back to your question, the photographic question, yeah, they are low light, and they were particularly low light because a lot of punk rock bands wouldn't be in regular clubs. They would be in hall shows, you know, where it's just like the back room of a Chinese restaurant or, you know, whatever. And there wasn't stage lighting. There was just lighting. And even when they did play clubs like the 930 Club, a lot of them didn't, you know, because it was punk, they didn't want to look like rock stars or anything. So they were just like, just white light and turn it down, like no colored lights or anything, which kind of bugged me as a photographer. But but back then it was, nowadays, most clubs say like first three songs, no flash. That's like the rule for photography. You're not allowed to use a flash and you only get the first three songs. Back then, there were no rules. You could definitely use flash, which I did. And that was you were able to freeze the action. So I have a lot of photographs of people jumping in the air or band members jumping up and you know, they're frozen because of the flash. But occasionally I would shoot without a flash if the lights were good. And there was a specific kind of film that I had called T-Max 3200. It was a very fast film, meaning that it does well in low light. And I took some kind of beautiful pictures of like Fugazi and stuff where they're just really nice blacks and nice dramatic lighting and, you know.
I'm shocked and very happy to hear that you didn't kind of, you know, get any equipment damaged and you didn't get hurt. But like, I am aware that, again, there's this freedom, there's this wildness almost, you know, contained a little bit. But Did you ever, you know, kind of resent your role as the photographer? I mean, I understand that, you know, this was very much a vocation for you, but didn't you just sometimes wish you could just be pogoing and free and wild like everyone else, rather than, you know, framing your shots and all of that kind of thinking that you had to do about your art?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a lot of my friends at the time would say, why don't you leave your camera at home, just come and dance and enjoy the show. But yeah. When I wasn't not enjoying the show when I was taking pictures. And the times that I did leave my camera at home, I kind of felt like something would happen, like the lights would be particularly good or the band would do something that I never saw them do before. And I would always regret it, you know? And it's not because I really felt like I have to, like, take a piece of this home with me. Like, I can enjoy a moment for the moment. But, because then you get into a whole other thing about nowadays, about people and cell phones. And you're watching a performance through a screen. Like, just watch it. Just be here now and enjoy it. But I didn't really feel I was doing that. I felt that it was something very special and that I needed to document it. I had utterly no idea I would still be talking about it 40 years later, or I would have sold 2,000 copies of a book and had to put out another edition because people still wanted it. Like I really had no idea. It was because I needed to do it. I just felt like it was important.
We'll be right back with more of June's conversation with Jim Sa.
This podcast is brought to you by Slate Studios and SAP. AI is moving so fast. If you don't get reliable and relevant advice, your business might miss out. Welcome to Dear Artie, an advice column from SAP, where we tackle the tricky questions at the intersection of AI and business. Let's meet our expert.
Hi, I'm Ian Khan. I'm a technology futurist, speaker, and author, and I love to help organizations measure their current state of readiness for an AI-driven world. I'm excited to dive into today's question.
Dear Artie, our finance team is top-notch, but small. How can AI support them? Signed, Financially Drained.
Well, financially drained, a lot is happening in finance and AI, and the possibilities are endless. First of all, AI can help your finance team analyze massive amounts of financial data faster than any human or a team of people could do. Second, it can help perform functions on data through algorithms. This can connect different systems together and really simplify decision-making for your finance team. And last but not least, AI can help reduce the time needed for data to provide insights so that your leaders can make faster decisions.
Embrace AI with confidence. Head to sap.com/AI to learn more.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep. While you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 366 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Every other Thursday on Working Overtime, we offer advice on how to get creative work done. So please tell us your challenges and let us help you. Drop us a line at working@slate.com. You can also send a voice memo to that address or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's return to June's conversation with Jim Sah.
So, I'm wondering if there was a particular vibe that you were trying to capture. Looking at In My Eyes, your book, there are certainly lots of images of people, you know, I guess I would say in extremis, you know, they're really screaming or feeling or experiencing the music in the scene. Was there, like I say, a vibe that you were trying to capture when you were, you know, looking through your viewfinder?
Yeah, I have to say that I was young and just started with photography, so it would be disingenuous to say that I had this fully formed aesthetic at that time, but I was definitely building one, because in retrospect, you can see it play out. Like, there was a lot of people that would take pictures. Like, the audience was always part of my photography, like, yeah. Not just the performer, because that's what attracted me to punk rock. Before I went to punk rock, I'd go to arena shows, you know, yeah. And the performers are these little people way down there, and you're sitting in your seat, and it's a spectator thing. But punk rock, you could be involved, you could participate, you know, as you can see in some of my pictures, there's more people on the stage, you know, singing along and stuff. And that's what really attracted me to it. One of the things that really attracted me to it. And yeah. I really loved that aspect. So I would either get on the stage or to the side of the stage so I could include some of the audience and the members. And all the action and the energy of the performers and the audience was definitely interesting to capture with the dancing and the jumping and everything. But I realized later that I often captured these, you know, what I say, like, quiet moments for punk rock. Like there's a shot of the band The Faith where the singer is just leaning back and the audience are straining, the hands are straining up to, like, you know, catch him, and he's not really mm-hmm. falling. He's just singing, and his head is back. And then, like, the one I mentioned earlier of Fugazi with the low light and the fast film, he's just standing there looking down. You see the Marshall amp, and he's in this pool of light, and it's like he's so in it, but he's not screaming, or he's, you know, it's a quiet kind of moment. And I have a lot of images like that.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. You know, I still look for those. And that has become that was, you know, part of my growing aesthetic that I kind of realized later. I'm a photojournalist by trade, so I'm not a conceptual artist. So I don't really try to think about or define things too much. I just go with how I feel and see how things come out.
Wow. And I know this is kind of an impossible question, but was there a general number of photographs that you would take every evening?
Well,
or afternoon?
Yeah, that's actually not a very hard question, because I was shooting film. So I only had, like, nowadays I could say, oh, I could shoot 50 or 3,000 at a show, depending
right.
on what's going on. But back then, you know, film wasn't cheap. I didn't have a lot of money. There were 36 frames on a roll, and I would have, on average, 2 to 3 rolls. And that was usually it. If it was one of my favorite bands, or it was, they used to be, those matinees were like five bands, $5, you know, or I would shoot every band. Even if I didn't even know who they were, yeah. I wouldn't spend a lot of film on them, but if I liked them, you know, and that worked out kind of cool because later on I found out I had pictures of bands that I didn't even know I had, you know.
And so what happened with all those rolls of film? So say you had three rolls of 36 from, you know, the concert. What was the next step after you'd left the concert? What would happen?
Yeah, I would develop and print everything myself in my own darkroom. So I would always be very anxious to see. Nowadays, you can see what you got right away, but there was a process, and I would be very anxious to develop them. And then I would make a contact sheet, which is just the images, you know, on a sheet the same size as the negative, so very small. And then I'd look at that with a magnifying glass and circle 3, 4, 5, however many I thought were good, and then make prints of those. And an interesting thing, when I scanned everything, you know, many years later, I found that I had a lot more interesting photographs than I thought, because when you see things small, sometimes you don't really get the full sense of it. And when I saw everything big on a computer screen, I had a lot more photos that I never gave a second look at before.
Because you were effectively seeing the contact sheet.
Yeah, just this one inch by a half an inch thing. And, you know, you look at it with a magnifying glass, but it's still, like, there's one image of Fugazi that I never really even looked at. And then my editor for my publisher and kind of editor, there was a few editors, but he looked at it and he was like, that shot's amazing. And I was like, really? And then I looked at it, and there's just, it's mainly because it's a real wide shot and there's a lot of things going on. So I guess real small, it didn't really read, you know, like much. But like one of the singers is jumping up and the other one is like, you know, like leaning over, playing his guitar, and there's a stage diver dancer running into the scene. And this woman that Fugazi had a song called Suggestion, which was about objectifying women. So when they played it locally, they would have a friend of theirs, a woman, sing it, you know, because it was like more appropriate. And she's like, you know, freaking out. And it's, there's a lot of action, you know. So I never really gave that one a second look until it was bigger.
Well, the other part of, you know, having this limited number, this finite number, as you say, is, well, now we don't. Now, I don't know how many thousands of pictures I could take just with my phone, much less with a camera with a big memory card in it. Like, how did that change the way that you thought about the images that you wanted to get? And do you still kind of hold on to some of that now when there are no finite limits on how many images you could take?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's like, as I mentioned earlier, I was able to use a flash then. And most of the time, unless it's a hall show, you're not allowed to use flash. And the lighting nowadays, there used to be, you know, like stage lighting, those hot lights. Now everything's LED lights. And a lot of bands want to create a mood and they'll just have this blue wash or red wash, and it's horrendous for photography. It really looks terrible. And if you're not allowed to use a flash, you know, they opened a new club that was supposed to be kind of like an homage to the old 930 club. It's the same people that own the new 930 club. It's called the Atlantis, which was the name of the old 930 club before it was 930 club. And I shot like 44 bands. Like they had an inaugural 44 bands because it was 44 years ago. And big bands played this small club, like the Foo Fighters and the Pretenders and stuff. But I would shoot, you know, hundreds of images and the percentage of good ones was not the same percentage as the 72 images I might have took before. And that doesn't, I don't think that speaks to me being any less of a photographer or, you know, I don't just, as they say, spray and pray, where you just like take a bunch of photos and then hope you get one. Like, I'm very particular and I usually know the music and I'm waiting for a moment. And for instance, there's a photo of the band Marginal Man that the singer is jumping so high that you see the drummer behind him, like through his legs. And, you know, I had one shot to take that. It had to be a flash because it had to freeze it because the lighting, it was in the back room of a restaurant. And it bugs me, like when I give talks, like I was a judge in a photo slam the other couple months ago. And I talked about this, you know, in more geeky detail because the room was full of photographers. But it's really difficult. And a lot of people like to go back to hall shows and shoot smaller bands so they can still use a flash and have more control. But yeah, I was very discerning and still am. And I would, you know, even if I shot two rolls, I would end up with half a dozen good shots, you know?
Yeah.
With these hard circumstances and people flying everywhere and, you know.
Indeed.
I still end up with good shots, but the ratio is much less because of you're really dependent on the lighting. And
wow.
Like, and when you get the first three songs, like I shot this British artist at the 930 Club that's pretty popular. And you get the first three songs and it was practically dark. Like there was barely any lights on for the first three songs. And that's it, you know? I mean, I don't know if they're doing it on purpose or what, but, you know, it's very restricting.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. And I take it you know photographing color. I mean, I guess the only way you can photograph in black and white now is just to do some processing after the fact, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I do still. There used to not be good tools to make digital color images in the black and white that looked the way as good as the black and white photography ones. But now there are. Like and I don't do, as I said, I'm a photojournalist. I don't like to do a lot of manipulation. I don't actually change anything that's not in the image. But I use the same tools that I would use in the darkroom, you know, contrast, density, dodging, burning. And, you know, in like Photoshop or Lightroom, you can really get good blacks. So I still... And there's monochromatic cameras that, you know, like Leica makes one that just takes black and white photos, which seems cool, but it's like costs $8,000. So, you know.
And, must be nice.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah. I don't, and you can set your camera to only take black and white, but I find that it's better to shoot in color because you get more information and then you can change it. And the controls nowadays are, you can really fine tune it to make it look really nice.
And so this book, in my eyes, ends in 1997, right? What have you been doing since then? I take it you've been a professional photographer, a freelance photographer. You know, how did your life change in 1997? Or is that just a kind of a cutoff for the book?
Yeah, that was just a cutoff for the book because I wanted this book to be all on film, no digital photography.
Oh.
And as far as what I've been doing since then, yes, I discovered photography at 16, 17. I discovered the music. I started taking pictures of bands. I loved taking pictures of bands, but I just loved taking photos. And I went to school for photography for a couple years, and then I was going to go ahead and finish, you know, and get a bachelor's degree, but I started shopping my portfolio around And I started getting hired. And I ended up in, you probably remember the city paper because you were from here. Yeah. So I started small with community papers and free weeklies. And then I ended up in the Washington Post. And I figured, well, I could continue with school, but now I'm doing what I'm going to school for. So I just started doing it. And my first picture was published in the Washington Post in 1986. And that opened up other doors. I freelanced for them for, you know, the next 25 years. I mean, I still occasionally have something in there, but, you know, newspapers and photography, it's a whole other conversation about, like, I used to make more in 1986 than I would make today, which is insane. But, you know, cell phones and the how people value photography is all has changed. But that's why I gave this book. I wanted to give punk rock the art book treatment. So it's a 12 by 12 inch coffee table size, 332 page, 6 pound book that has 60 bands and tons of photos. And it's not like punk rock. Like, you'll see some books where people, they want to simulate the way the music is, and there's like flyers and this. It's just nice black and white pictures on white or black pages. And it's like, I wanted it to be like if you're looking at them in a gallery or something.
Yeah.
And I think people that have bought it have really appreciated that, because I get that a lot. Like, this is such a beautiful book. It's like, it's just, the pictures are gorgeous, the quality. It's, you know, I used good paper and it's a hardcover and everything.
And 12 inches, of course.
Size of a record.
Yeah, exactly.
That was on purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, which I'm sure nowadays some people be like, what, 12 inch what? I don't know what.
Yeah.
Jim Saw, this was really fascinating. Thank you for talking to us about your process.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Up next, June and I will dive deeper into the punk scene and also talk about the differences between shooting on film and digital and what that means for other artists in other mediums. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. June Thomas. What an interesting interview. As a resident of the DMV, I've often heard of Bad Brains. They are notorious in this region. And I know about their contributions to punk. But my personal introduction to the punk scene was down in Richmond, Virginia in the early 2000s when I was in college at VCU. And I was a sheltered church kid and I never went to a show. But I worked a security job, and it just so happened that at that job, there were a lot of students who were deeply engaged in the punk scene that also worked there. Huh. So I often heard them playing a lot of music that I didn't understand. But growing up as a gospel kid, I appreciated the fandom and the connection to the music that was very niche and very popular within that niche. So from your interview, I got the impression that this was kind of your position as well, appreciating the fandom, but not exactly of the punk scene. Did I get that right? Or what is your relationship to punk music? Set me straight.
Well, Ronald, you got it exactly right. I lived in DC during the mid 80s, and I was really aware of the punk shows and the venues where they happened without ever attending a punk show myself. As I mentioned in the interview, I had neighbors who were straight edge punks, and I was quite appreciative of the way they kind of moved through the world, the rules they set for themselves, mostly because I've always admired various kinds of intentional living, even when people are, you know, sticking to a set of constraints that I would not want to take on for myself. Mm-hmm. I must admit, though, that punk had a particular appeal to me. I was a teenager in 1977 when bands like the Sex Pistols and the Stranglers, the Buzzcocks, X-Ray Specs, when they broke through.
I love these names.
I know, right? Great names. And while I wasn't that into the music, in most cases at least, I loved the DIY spirit.
Yes.
In many ways, punk rock was a way of like standing up to the big record labels and the massive arena shows that were so expensive and these kids were saying, or really screaming, we've got something to say. We're going through the same things you're going through, and we're just going to put on a show. And I really liked the way that punk democratized creativity. Anybody can make music. Anybody can put on a show. I love that.
You know, honestly, that sounds a lot like podcasting. Like, right? Because basically the barrier to entry for podcasting is so low now. Like, you could think of a podcast today and be making it tomorrow. And I'm not, I don't need anyone to be writing letters and saying, Ronald says that podcasting is punk rock now. But I love that that DIY spirit is still alive. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're exactly right.
There's a certain way that Jim talks about using film versus digital photography, which is very important to him. And I've heard similar discussions when it comes to using analog versus digital audio recording or even video recording. And there's even several directors who prefer to film with IMAX cameras, like those giant IMAX cameras that you have to pay all this money for film for. And I think Christopher Nolan has done it. Jordan Peele has done it. But they do it because it has a particular look that digital cameras can't quite provide. And I love this type of attention to detail. I love it. And I know what that means to the auteurs who make these types of choices. But I'm wondering, when it comes to you as a writer, do you ever think about the difference between typing and actually physically handwriting something? And does typing your work ever feel like you're taking something away from the work that you're creating?
Wow. Well, I love analog writing tools. I use them all the time. But not really for professional writing. I'm too addicted to constant self-editing, and I have to be more efficient. I do know people, weirdos, honestly, who use typewriters or typewriter-like devices where you can only go forward, so to speak. You can't edit as you go. And they use these tools because they're prone to get lost in the perpetual self-editing that software enables. They're so perfectionist that they will keep revising the same sentence. And with a typewriter, they can at least get a draft down before they get to the revision stage. So I get that that can be useful to some people, but I don't have time for that. I do think it's extra interesting with film or photos, though. I am not a photographer or videographer, but it's a world that fascinates me just as an outsider. And I'm very interested in the ways that, for example, YouTubers, who often work with, you know, not nothing, but very little, work to make their videos more cinematic, is the term they always use. And in that case, it's not so much about going back to earlier methods as using like hyper-modern techniques, you know, digital editing software that you can use on your phone to make things look more expensive, more professional. So that whole question of what do we use and why are we using it, I just think is endlessly fascinating.
I mean, it ends up being a question about styles. What is your style of creating? And I think for some people, whatever they're attached to becomes kind of like what imprints on them as what should be the style that they are creating in. For some people, it's like seeing something that's grainier with more distortion. And other people like things that are crystal clear and cinematic. And we have the tools to do both, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can choose. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Another thing I've been thinking about recently is that we take all of these pictures now, and it's likely that the majority of the pictures that we take will only be seen by us on our phones, and they'll likely disappear when we die. And I've only thought about this recently because my mother died recently, as we've talked about a lot on the show, and we unlocked her phone because she gave us access and all that. And we made a shared album with all of the pictures on her phone. And it occurred to me that we just inherited all of the pictures from her phone. So like I have them, they're now saved to my Google Drive. And it occurred to me, like, who's going to do that for me? Like, we spend all of this time now creating what is now a digital memory. Like, everyone talks about being tracked all the time by software and all that stuff that knows everything you're doing, where you're going, all that stuff. But that is creating a digital memory made out of data, which is a lot of ways can be very, like, attached to who you are. And the idea of losing all that data and losing all that digital memory after I'm gone, it just doesn't feel quite right to me. I'm wondering if you ever think about this, June. Like, do you have any ideas about preserving our pictures, our digital memories? Like, what do you think?
I do think about this larger question all the time. I'm very much a word person rather than an image person, by which I mean, like, when something is happening, I tend to observe it so that I can describe it with words. Whereas for a lot of people, as soon as something odd happens, they pick up their camera immediately and they record it that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's just a different approach. The same thing goes when it comes to research. My first thought is always to go looking for written records, archives, old magazines to ask people questions. I've learned, though, that old photos are such an amazing resource.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of listeners are just going, duh, right now. But again, because I'm not an image first person, this is something I had to figure out from experience. So when I was writing my book, which was about lesbian spaces, I was pretty deep into the project before I realized, you know, June, if you just Google these people's names, these places, just type some words into that box and then look in the images tab,
yeah,
there is a very good chance you'll find photos that will tell you things you haven't found for yourself, you know, with all these words yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, that really increased my sense of the value of those old images. The more banal, the better. And I think that's true for any art form. Like when you're making a piece of audio, when you're making a podcast, when you're making a narrative show, even if it's quote unquote just audio, if you Google, you know, and look at the images that come up for a person, a place, a word, it's going to, you know, give you different ideas. And it's just, that's just not something I thought about doing until really quite recently.
Yeah.
Back in September 2020, Ali Edwards was my guest on Working. She's part of the scrapbooking world. She
yes.
makes products and organizes projects that help people document their lives, particularly the things that we do every day and don't usually get celebrated, our relationships, what's important to us. And I was really persuaded of the importance of doing that kind of documentation. For all that, though, my photo roll is an absolute dumpster fire.
Yes.
I've been trying to do more posting on Instagram recently. And one of the things I thought I could do would be to post like a monthly wrap up of the most significant things I did in the last month. I guess
that's
pretty standard things.
Yeah.
And I was just overwhelmed. Like just even looking at 30 days worth of pictures, they're just mostly just random meals and Pokemon and weird things I saw on the street. It was a nightmare. And if I didn't have a book to sell, I'm not sure I would have done it.
No, I get it.
So it's all very well to say, and I really believe it's important, but oh my God, we take so many pictures. It takes so much time to like manage it, right?
It does. I think I'm glad that there's tools and stuff that are embedded in our camera and our cloud apps that actually let you search by face and all that. So you can see all that, even though it's the idea of being able to facial recognition is a little bit terrifying if you think about it too much. It is good to know that there's some way to organize that. And I want you to not feel alone because everyone's camera roll is a mess. Like if you went through anyone's camera roll from month to month, everyone has too many pictures and they're going back. Because the thing is, one of the best parts of going back in your camera roll, and this, which is one of the features I like about any of this stuff, this is not a commercial for Google Drive by any means or Google Photos, but that it shows you memories from a random day of pictures that you took, stuff that you might have otherwise forgot about. And then if you go back to that day, you can look at all these pictures and things that you've forgot that do record all of your life, which I think is pretty wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We hope that you enjoyed the show. If you have, remember to subscribe everywhere you get your podcasts. Then you'll never miss an episode. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Slow Burn, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
Thanks to Jim Saw for being our guest this week and to our producer, Cameron Drews, who makes our digital recordings sound analog AF. But only if that's good. We'll be back next week with Isaac's conversation with author Sally Franson. Until then, get back to work. When you hear a good idea, it's natural to do a double take. That's what you might do when you hear Discover will automatically double the cashback you've earned on your credit card at the end of your first year with Cashback Match. Wait, what? Yep, double the cashback is something so good you might do a triple take. Get rewarded no matter who you are or how much you spend with Discover. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.